Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. It is also the perfect place for BoucherCon 2018, which is coming up. It is very exciting for us. It's right here at the Vinoy Hotel, downtown St. Petersburg, and we are looking forward to welcoming so many writers here, including Lee Child and Karen Slaughter. Oh, just tons of them, and many of them are going to be, have already been on Joy on Paper, and they're going to be joining me over the next few weeks. But right now, I want to turn to somebody. I have two guests right now, William Oldfield and Victoria Bruce, and they have written a book together called Inspector Oldfield and the Black Hand Society. It's a nonfiction book, but it's one of those rare nonfiction books that's so thrilling, it's like reading a novel. Hi, are you there, William? Who's there first? William?
Yes, good morning. It's William, and you can call me Hammy as well. That's my nickname.
Yes, that's what I wanted to ask, if I could call you Hammy. I've always wanted to call somebody Hammy. And it's adorable. I love it. And is Victoria with you?
I'm here. Hi, Patsy.
Hi. Wow. You two, what have you done here? You have written a book that it's like a thriller from, you know, the best-selling thriller writer in the world.
Oh, my gosh. That is such a huge compliment coming from you. Thank you so much.
Wow. You guys have done a marvelous, marvelous job. It's brilliant. I'm telling you, it's brilliant. We'll have to tell everybody about it because, of course, Hammy, you started it because it is the story of your great-grandfather. And the story just of you discovering the story is amazing. And then, of course, Victoria, you came in and put this book together, and it is so good.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, I mean, like you said, it came from Hammy and his family, and I was just so lucky to get to be part of this project.
Well, I always love to learn new things, and this book is about really America's original gangsters and the U.S. Postal Detective who brought them to justice, and that, of course, was your great-grandfather. And tell us, Hammy, about the story behind him and how you came to write this book.
I knew you were going to ask that question. I was looking on your website, and you like to know how the story develops and where it comes from. And candidly, I didn't know if I wanted to write this book, and then I did want to write it, then I didn't want to write it, back and forth, because it went all the way back to when we were 8, 9 years old, my sister and I. And we first were exposed to this massive collection that my uncle had brought up from the basement of his apartment in Columbus, Ohio. And all these boxes and with thousands of photos and pictures, and it was actually real trial evidence. And, you know, we wondered, where the heck did he get this from? And once he started laying it out on the floor in front of my parents and my sister and I, you know, sitting on the floor, all of us looking at it together, we said, this is absolutely amazing. John Frank Oldfield, you know, this, and all these swarthy characters, the bad guys with big mustaches and daggers and photographs. And we just were absolutely amazed. And then it got all packed up. And the finger waggling from the adults started. And they said, you absolutely can never say anything about this for the rest of your life. Now, how do you say that to a child at 8 or 9 years old and have them expect them to be able to keep a secret? You know, but we did. We did. They used the fear of the bad guys. And then about 12, 13 years old, the collection came out again one night that had been stashed away in our family home, where my uncle and my cousin, older guys, had come over and were just so curious, because through these family stories at Thanksgiving, Christmas, whatever, the word was slipping out amongst the family, and then the same finger waggling before everybody left. You know, that you never know who's living next door to you. Well, so it took many years after that, and I kept the promises. We never knew who lived next door to us. They were all living around us, all their descendants, many of them quite successful, and politicians, very prominent. And so we really had to show a respect for both the descendants and for our own family members, you know, to protect them from possible retaliation. I mean, up in northeastern Ohio and the Great Lakes, all we heard about in the news in the 60s and 70s was bombings and mafia this and mafia that. It was everywhere up there in the industrial Great Lakes. So after talking with both my parents individually, unfortunately, during my father's period of dying and, during my mother's period of dying, both of them really wanted me just to let it go. And to eventually, my mother even said, you know, before she passed away, just burn it. Move on with your life. And but I think she discovered that it was impossible. I couldn't let it go. And finally she said, you know, just tell the truth on both sides. That's the best way to tell the story.
And that's how it began. And we hope that the word vendetta is no longer in anybody's vocabulary.
Thank you so much. That's why this is a telephone interview.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is such an intriguing story. Most people don't know that much about the post office, except that they're always raising the price of stamps. I happen to know a great deal about the post office, and I will tell you this story one day because they might have a vendetta against me. But I want you to tell the background of what Frank Oldfield was and how he got into this position and how important it was in those days.
Oh, you've got to let Vicki tell this because I love her impressions of what I told her and then when she dug in, because I don't think she believed it.
Well, I was a little incredulous at the time. You know, here's a guy, he comes into a coffee shop and he starts telling me, you know, my great-grandfather busted the first mafia ring in America 10 years before Prohibition. You've never heard of it, and all the evidence is back in my apartment. You know, I'm like, really?
That was almost exactly how it sounded at a coffee shop.
So I do have, like most people, I didn't know that before the FBI, there was this amazing law enforcement agency that's still around today, but very much on the down low. They kept quiet, and they were busting bank robbers, and that was the postal inspecting service. That was the only federal law enforcement. So everything went by mail. Bags of gold, you know, letters, everything. So anytime a crime touched the mail, these guys were involved. And so Frank, who was always getting into trouble growing up in the late 1800s, and he's in Ellicott City, Maryland, and his dad is, like, dying to get him a job and get him out of trouble, gets him a job as a U.S. Post Office inspector. And the first time, he actually blows it, and he's the first post office inspector to get fired. But he gets reinstated, and he actually becomes, like, this amazing post office inspector and busts some of the biggest cases. And then, you know, what he's really wanting to do is get a hold of this Italian crime community and figure it out, because no one can. You know, he really wants to bust into that.
And it is fascinating that no one understands the reach of the postal inspectors at that time. I mean, they could go any place in the world and go after people.
Well, that's exactly right. The case. You have to understand, with the history of the post office, all the way back to the beginning of our country, treaties were founded with other countries, because how could we do commerce around the world? Everything was shipped through the post. And so people who wanted to do business, both domestically and internationally, you know, had to rely on the post. So somebody had to protect the integrity of the post office and all the goods and things that were going through the post. And so these men at the time, and now there are quite a few women involved, it's actually about 1,100 people strong now, inspectors. But there were very few back then, and they were sent out to really commercial hubs around the United States and overseas, where they could really monitor the behavior, you know, of people involved using the post and protect it. And because of that far reach back then, they had carte blanche authority. They could chase anybody. In fact, there's a great New York Times article from 1909 that says a post office inspector can take 5 years if it takes that long to chase someone down and just continue on the case until he basically runs the criminal to ground, as they used to say.
And certainly Frank Oldfield was that kind of an inspector. I mean, he took his job seriously. How did he get this idea that he could bring down you know, a group of mafiosa people that no one else thought could be infiltrated even.
Yet no one else even believed there was organized crime at the time, Patsy. It was like the cops were like, no, these are just random bombings, random kidnappings, random, you know, extortion. They had no insight into the Italian communities. None of the police spoke Italian. None of the federal marshals, Secret Service. So they just, it was kind of like left alone. And so Frank got word of this because he, a murder happened in Bellefontaine, Ohio. And there were actually death threat letters in the guy's pocket, in the victim's pocket. So that put it in Frank's jurisdiction. They called him from Columbus, ran over there, was like, okay, I'm going to solve this case, and there must be something going on because there's these letters. So he starts trying to talk to the Italians in the community, and they're just like completely blow him off. Like, they don't want to have anything to do with this tiny, you know, skinny, white, pasty guy who's like wearing a perfect derby hat. He was meticulous about what he wore, you know, these designer suits. And he just had no luck, but he never gave up. And no one, even though no one was believing him, he said he knew that this was a big deal and somehow he was going to break this case.
And did he break it? Because he got people on trial. And the important thing is he actually got Italians to testify against these gangsters, which...
Well, you know, yes, Patsy. I'll tell you, there's a different time and place in the way this we put together. In the book, we don't get into some of the details about Miranda, but before the Miranda decision, federal inspectors, even police officers, had a little bit more leeway than they do today. And he had to basically...
a little bit more.
More ways to encourage people.
Yes, and so there's a bit of coercion that went on both sides of the fence, on the victim side as well as the bad guy side. And so a little arm twisting and maybe even more than that went on to cajole and convince some of these victim families who'd already been terrorized beyond what any family could probably handle even today. You know, warnings of that they'll be slashed in the face on the street, or they'll be kidnapped, or their business will be bombed. Some even moved back to Italy because they finally just gave up. They were, because the cost of doing business in the United States had become so great because they were paying so much of their money, their profits, to these bad guys. So, and Vicky, when I told her a little bit about Frank's and his cohorts, some of their behavior, she did some deep digging. And Vicky, if you want to throw a few of those out there.
Well, yeah, like Hammy said, I mean, it's just the story, it had so much depth, and I think, you know, it was volumes. When he first approached me, he said, you know, we need to do 5 books. Of course, that's what everybody, if you look at the amount of archival material, you'll see why. But yeah, he's right. I mean, incredible characters, incredible stories, and we were very lucky. I felt very lucky to be able to help tell this story.
I think we're both lucky, Vicky.
Well, it's a wonderful pairing. I'm going to tell you something. As I'm reading this book and I'm saying to myself, well, there's so much here. There's just so much. There's really more than, you know, that for one book. I mean, it's chock full of stuff and it's really great. And, of course, it's nonfiction. So I'm thinking, but as I'm going along, I'm thinking, first of all, I'd like to make this into a film. And then I'm thinking, whoa, this could be a miniseries. And then I'm thinking, my goodness, it reminded me, and I hope that you guys are seriously thinking about this, because there's a wonderful series. I don't know if you've ever read it. It's with Marsha Muller and Bill Pronzini. They are Mystery Writer of America grandmasters, both of them. Luckily, she she became a grandmaster before. Bill did. But they've both been on the program. And they have this wonderful series called... Professional Detective Services, and their heroes are Carpenter and Quincannon. But the point is, this series is based in San Francisco in the 1890s, and it is a wonderful series, and they've written it together. And I think the two of you should really seriously think about writing a series of fiction books with, of course, the hero being Inspector Oldfield, an Inspector Oldfield series, because you have so much, you both have done so much research, and you are able, you have this wonderful ability to bring the time alive and to really set us in the place that, you know, you're writing about. And I'm thinking, you must really, don't stop that, because I think you somehow you of course, I have to say, you know, to tell my listeners that Victoria Bruce is a brilliant author on her own. And you've done some incredible nonfiction books. But I think the two of you, if you pair up, you could write. No, seriously, because there's so much information. And I think so much of it is information that people will really like to know. I mean, the things I didn't know, for example, about the mafia connection in Louisiana. I didn't know this. And so,
oh, I didn't know that either.
And
yeah,
so that's why I love all this, you know, and to follow Inspector Oldfield and others, other inspectors all over the world. I mean, you guys have the makings here. I rarely get a nonfiction book where I say, take that and run with it like crazy, because
thank you so much.
You've got right here. You have so much information, and you don't want it to sort of just dissipate. You know, there's a time limit. First of all, a nonfiction book, you'll have a great run right now, and it'll be there for years. People will use as references, but I don't want all this material to be forgotten. I want you guys to sit down together and plot out a series, Inspector Oldfield series, and then we're gonna once you finish the books, then we will talk about doing a mini series, because he's fascinating. And let just talk a little bit, because I like Inspector Oldfield's wife. So tell a little bit more about the family, about the dynamics there, and why there are some of the threats that were made against them.
Yeah, I didn't hear I didn't hear the last part, Patsy.
Some of the threats that they faced.
Oh my gosh, they started early. That's all I can say. They started a long time ago. Frank had to be domiciled, as they called it in those days, stationed. Initially, he was shipped out from, after being a bad boy and getting fired and reinstated in Chattanooga, he was shipped off from Ellicott City all the way out to Cincinnati, Ohio, which was sort of the biggest regional domicile, you know, for the federal detectives. Because funny enough, that's where the mail at that point transferred from Cincinnati to Missouri to the West Coast. And so there were field offices, and they stuck him. Abraham Holmes, by the way, was his inspector in charge of the Cincinnati office, and a more traditional, very successful inspector of his own right, but very conservative. So they ship Oldfield off to Columbus, Ohio. And so he puts his family in Athens, Ohio, where Ohio University is. At that time, that would be very far away when it came with transportation. Today, it's just a little drive. But that was able to protect Margaret Galena, his wife, and his four boys from any retaliation, because he had many, many threats, not just the Black Hand, but he was a very busy inspector. A classic story our family was threatened heavily was burglar Jim Anderson. And he was a safe cracker and post offices and really a troublemaker. And so Oldfield had to track him down. Burglar Jim wanted Oldfield dead. But that one was finally reconciled, because finally when Oldfield was able to catch him, and in the book we really have some fun with that quick story. We don't want to reveal it all now. But Oldfield came to visit Burglar Jim and to pick more information out of him while he was in the Ohio Penitentiary. And eventually the Oldfields continued to send cards and make sure the family was okay and had money. And then the Burglar Jim's family continued to send cards and letters to us his family for many years.
You have so much material here. I can see, like, I see one book. I can just go through here, and I already identified like five different stories that I think would make books. So I think you're going to be on a roll here. I think once you go out, I know that you have a lot of speaking engagements, and I think we'll find the same thing, that people who read this book will have the same enthusiasm because you are able to tell a story so well and with such fascinating detail that I really hope that you will, you know, think about doing a series.
I love that idea. Yeah, and I wanted to say, Patsy, I have a website, my author website, that has our speaking engagements listed on it. We start tomorrow night in Washington, D.C., and then we're in a lot of different places. So if you go to victoriabruce.com, that has a calendar right on the front, and love to have people come out and see us, because actually Hammy is going to bring some of the actual archive materials, the death threat letters. We have the originals, some daggers. They'll actually be able to, he's going to bring gloves, and people will be actually be able to touch these things that were what was used in the trial.
And that's one of the fascinating of so many stories in this book, the story about how It was the postal inspectors who really got involved in fingerprinting, and so many things that we now take for granted came from those postal inspectors' investigations.
Right. Yeah, and I think Frank was one of the first to actually do this, you know, multi-agency, interactive, intercontinental. I mean, he ran this thing like, you know, Ulysses S. Grant was his idol. His father loved him. He even has a little brother named Ulysses S. Grant Oakfield. That's how much the family loved the logistical and just massive brilliance of like a big campaign.
Oh,
and that's
my.
What Frank did to bring down these bad guys.
Oh my goodness! All the history that you can weave in to this story about Inspector Oldfield. The politics that he was involved in. I don't have enough time to talk about it all, but I know. Here's the deal. I want you back here in a year with your first, in the series of Inspector Oldfield books, because you have to get serious.
We would love it.
I think you can do it. You have the material and you have the talent. And Victoria Bruce, so the website is Victoria Bruce. You can see the list of where Hammy. I love it, Hammy. I think it's so great. Anyway, William Oldfield and Victoria Bruce will be talking about this great book, which I think is so much fun. I also love the cover. They did a great job. It's called Inspector Oldfield and the Black Hand Society. And it's available wherever books are sold, at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And as I said, it's rare that a nonfiction book reads like a thriller, but you guys have managed to do it. I think it's brilliant. And I know I'm going to have you back. And I also want to say, Victoria Bruce, I love that name. It's like it's like a silent film star. The minute I read it, I said, oh, maybe she was a silent film star. So,
Patsy, I always joke that Vicky has a face for screen and I have the face for radio.
Okay, well, I'm telling you, I want you guys back here on the radio a year from now. How about that? Is that a deal?
You're wonderful. You're so
excited. Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
So after this speaking engagement, get over there and start writing, okay?
Will do.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Okay, thank you so much.
Bye-bye, thank you.
Okay. Wow, it's a great book. I love it. I and the funny thing is, you know, I read it, and then I went back and I read little parts of it. And because it is so chock full of stuff that I didn't know about, and that always gives me a thrill. And you will love this book. Now, before we have a commercial, we're going to have a little book buzz from my great friend, Radio Rita Moreau. And here it is.
This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest Book Buzz Mystery. Today we are chatting about Shattered at Sea by author Cheryl Holland. This book is number 5 in the author's Web Glass Shop Mystery Series. Some cool stuff is that Cheryl Holland is a Florida mystery writer who lives right in our backyard in St. Petersburg, Florida. Even cooler is that the author weaves her knowledge of glass in each book of her series, and she uses St. Petersburg as a backdrop. Love it. In her previous novels, it was stained glass, fusing glass, and recycling glass. In Shattered at Sea, it's glass blowing, which has always fascinated me. Here's the buzz. Savannah Webb signs on to perform glass blowing on a ship, and part of the appeal is that she'll get a chance to reconnect with her boyfriend Edward's family. Edward's cousin Ian was to join them on the cruise, but he disappears at the beginning of the cruise, and the ship's authorities are quick to call it a suicide. Yikes! But then it gets worse when boyfriend Edward jumps to the top of the list of suspects. His fate is now in Savannah's glass-blowing hands, and she will have to do everything she can to clear his name before the glass is shattered at sea. Readers, this is a cozy mystery with a sharp edge. Grab Cheryl Holland's book number 5 and Webb's Glass Shop Mystery now and get ready to set sail. Hey, this is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper. For more of my suggestions on the mysteries you should not miss, go to our webpage, www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and click on Book Buzz. That's radio-joyonpaper. Rita Moreau buzzing off for now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow, and like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I would flip-flop all night long, I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you could move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed, it's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
MyPillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I, or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. And I am back, and I am just waiting for my next guest. It's a fantastic book. I have been so taken with this book that it's one of those books where you get it, you start reading, and after a little while you realize I'm in something special. And so I'm really looking forward to talking to her, and she's going to be on in a little while. It's Delia Owens. I hope she's on her way in, and we're going to be talking to her. And the name of the book is Where the Crawdads Sing, and so I'm just really excited about that. And I've been working really hard on my Facebook page lately because one has to do that, I discovered. And I want to thank everybody who has been going to Facebook. It is really very kind of you to like me on Facebook and to share both the videos and also the reviews that I put on about the various authors who are, on the program. I love books. And one of the things that I particularly want to tell people is that there is a book in everyone. Now, Delia Owens is going to come on soon, I hope any minute. And one of the things about her is she wrote nonfiction books. She wrote quite a few nonfiction books. And then at one point, she decided to write I'm just looking at Big Ed in there. Big Ed, I think we have a backup number for her. Nope. No answer. Okay, we don't know. We're waiting for her. We'll see what happens. I hope that she gets on, because I've been so impressed with her writing. One of her first books that I read actually was The Kalahari Years. And this is a story about when she was in Africa. And she is a conservationist, a research conservationist, and she spent 23 years in Africa. So she certainly had a lot of time there to observe nature, and she's a lover of nature. And so it was fascinating when she decided to write a book that she's actually based her book in North Carolina. So I'm hoping that we're able to get her on, because it is a lovely book. But I wanted to talk about every one of you. For example, we just talked to Hammy here, William Oldfield, about his great-grandfather, who was a fascinating person. And the story was almost forgotten. The family had letters. The family had souvenirs. The family had boxes of this. And they weren't doing anything with them. And for years, they never even thought about writing a book. And after a while, I'm sure at some point, people moving around from here to there, they would have all of this material would have disappeared. But here they took all this material and wrote a brilliant book. And here is an author now who's on the phone, and she has written a brilliant book. Delia, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you, Patsy.
Okay. Well, Delia, I am so thrilled to have you on today, because I had a few minutes here to talk to people about you and about this book. Is so amazing. I wasn't prepared for it, because I had read, you know, your Africa books. So when I first got it, and I, of course, Crawdads was a giveaway that it was not in Africa, because I don't think they have crawdads in Africa, do they?
No, they do not.
So the publicist sent me this thing. Do you want to read something by Delia Owens called "We're the Crawdads" thing? And I said, what's going on in Africa? What's going on in Africa there? You know, all sorts of animals. We've gotten some really invasive animals that people have let their pets free here in Florida. And they're growing massive, you know, quantities of really strange animals that don't belong here in Florida. So then I thought, well, we have the Africa expert on. She wrote the brilliant The Kalahari Years. She wrote The Eye of the Elephants. And I was thinking, some idiot has taken crawdads.
That's so funny.
But
you found out that is not what the book is about.
That is, I was happy. I was happy. It is actually set where the crawdads belong.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, wow.
I did not move species, but thank you so much for your comments. I really appreciate that.
Anyway, so tell everybody about Where the Crawdads Sing.
Okay, well, the book is based in the wild coastal marsh of North Carolina, and I chose that setting for practical and for poetic reasons. The practical reasons are that this story begins as with a young girl named Kaya. She's the heroine of the book, and she's only 6 years old, and she watches her mother walk away. And by the time she's 10 years old, she's watched most of her family members walk away and leave her, and she's left alone. And she has to survive in the marsh. Now, of course, by the time she's 10 years old, she has some skills. She knows how to fish. She knows how to build the fire in the camp stove and in the wood stove. And so, but the marsh, and there are multiple firewood. So it was realistic that a young girl could survive in that setting, and I wanted this to be a realistic story. the poetic reasons are that the marsh is so beautiful and full of wildlife. And this story, the story of how much a part of nature we are. Nature is all around us, but we are a part of that nature. And the marsh flows to this story, not only as a background, but as a character itself. And many of the clues to this mystery are brushed into the backdrop of the wild marsh.
Okay, now we're having a little bit of problem with your sound. Are you on a cell phone?
I'm on a cell phone.
Okay, well, hold it as close to your mouth as possible, so because I don't want to miss any of this. Okay. I'm telling you.
I can. Okay, go ahead.
That's.
There is a landline here. I could change to. But I'm at my sister's house. I'm not in a hotel room. I could change to her landline. I don't know how much better it would be.
Well, I'm wondering. Okay, well, let's try.
Is it faint or is it breaking up?
It was breaking up there, but now it sounds better. So, okay.
I'm holding a little bit closer, so let's do that.
Okay, because I don't want people to miss any of this. This, it is so. I expected beauty from you, but you've really, I don't know how many hours and days or so you lived. Did you live in the marsh? Because you wrote about it so beautifully. It is so poetic. It is so, it's breathtaking. We're going to have to, Ed, can you
tell me? Okay, we're going to get on the other phone. Let me go get on the other phone, Patsy.
Yeah, do that.
And I'll call you back.
I'll call you back. Call us
it
right
back.
It'll
take a few minutes.
Okay. We'll wait for you. You're worth waiting for.
Okay. All right. Bye.
Okay. I don't want to miss any of this. We'll get her right back. That's the problem sometimes with cell phones. I don't know where she is now. She's not in the marshes, and she's not in Africa. If you ever want to read wonderful, wonderful books about Africa, her book, I think The Eye of the Elephant, is one of the best books about Africa, from the perspective of what is happening there, and of course her love of animals and of conservation. So she's just a brilliant writer. And as I said, I had expected it to be about Africa, and I'm so happy because I've really taken lately to North Carolina books. There are so many wonderful stories coming out of North Carolina, and I wanted to tell her that also the Audible version of this book is brilliant, and so we will get her back. Hopefully she will be back in a minute, and so she can tell us more about the book. And again, as I mentioned, this is her first novel. She wrote nonfiction, and then she decided to write a novel. And this is what you can do. You might want to start. Everybody has a book in them. You might want to start with a memoir. You might want to start with a nonfiction book. Write a book about something that intrigues you, and you will find that. It makes it much easier for you. You write a book, and then you never know what it leads to. And a nonfiction book can lead you to a fiction book in no time, and then you have a brilliant, brilliant debut novel like the one we're talking about right now with Dele. Hi, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Is this better?
Oh, this is better. Now we're right here, Delia Owens. It sounds
okay, great.
Sounds like you're sitting next to me. So.
Oh, good. Perfect.
And
perfect.
I wish you were.
Oh, me too.
You are, as I said, wow. How, all those years of observation in Africa there, and you were brilliant at that. And then you come and you take us right there into the marshland. And make us feel that we're there. And this story is very touching. It's such a beautiful combination. It's a romance. There's a mystery. And of course the big thing with you is nature. And no one observes nature better than you do.
Oh, thank you so much, Patsy. It's been a huge part of my life, and I we are part of nature. And I feel that when I'm in nature, I feel it. And I want other people to feel that how important nature is to us. We came from nature. We are nature. And it is in our nature. And that's what this book is about, is how our behavior relates back to when we lived in the wild savannas in Africa. A lot of our behavior that we elicit today is genetically based, and it all is from nature.
Well, this story of the girl who's called the Marsh Girl.
Yes.
It's a perfect title for her. And so there's a mystery around her and what people think about her. So tell us more about the story, just the Marsh Girl story.
Well, the story is really about how isolation affects a person. And she grew up mostly on her own in this wild marsh. And because she was the people in the village called the people who lived in the marsh, they called them marsh trash. This is true history, there was a population of people who lived in the marsh for about 400 years. And she was Kaya would have been the last probably generation of people who lived there in the 1930s and 40s. But they had existed in the marsh for many years. And so they were discriminated against by the people who lived in the village. They called her the Marsh Girl, and they would not help her, even though she was a small child on her own. They called her names. And so she was rejected from their troop, so to speak. And we all have the genetic propensity to belong to groups, to belong to a troop, to have friends and family. And she was isolated. And part of what this book is about is how isolation and rejection can affect a person.
And the nature, how she becomes one with nature.
She does. She has to survive on her own, and she learns. She watches ravens and learns how to collect the mussels from them. She learns how to collect oysters. She learns about loyalty from hearing gulls. She makes friends with the gulls. She has these sorts of interactions with animals. They are her family. And you know what's also interesting to me is when I came back to this country after living in Africa for so long, and another reason I wanted to write this book is even I know people here, I have friends here who live in cities and live in towns, and they also feel isolation. A lot of us feel rejection and isolation, and some of this story, it's about a lot of different things, but part of the story is how isolation affects us and how rejection can change a person.
Well, as a child, I was so lucky that I was raised in northern Michigan, which is a beautiful area. And in those days, up to a few years ago, we couldn't even get good reception on cell phones. So when I was a kid, we didn't have, of course, any cell phones. We didn't have any television to speak of. And we lived a wild life. We spent our entire summer in nature. We ran in the forest like crazy. We carried our Kool-Aid and our peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and we were gone all day long in nature. We read our books sitting in apple trees, and we were so aware of what was around us, about the animals around us and the trees. And I still marvel every time I hear, the leaves rustling in a tree. And so I really feel sad for the children of this generation who are raised in the cities and they don't hear anything. And so that's why when, you title your book, Where the Crawdads Sing, most kids will never hear anything. They hear this, garbage all the time around them, and they don't hear simple things like that.
It's a great loss to us as a nation and to humans in general. Most areas of the world, we have lost that. And that's where the title comes from. When I was growing up in South Georgia, my mother would encourage me and my friends to go as far out into the woods as we could go. And in those days in South Georgia, you could go a long way out in the woods. And she wanted me to experience true nature. And she would say to me, go way out yonder where the crawdads sing. And I've spent as much of my life in the wilderness as I can, and I've learned from it. And it's sad today that people can experience that. But I think that we need to try to get back to being in nature as much as we can, and that's partly conserving it, but also getting out to where it is let. We do have some beautiful wildlife places.
And we do.
We need to get out of that. We need to get in it because, as I say in this book, where the crawdads sing is where our secrets lie. We came from that. Many of the ways that we behave came from how we were when we lived there. And so we understand ourselves better if we understand nature better.
Well, one of the things I recommend to people, I say, you know, take time, and in our area, we're very lucky, we have this wonderful botanical garden, and you can go there and you can sit there for hours and just observe nature. Watch the birds, and of course, don't get, here it's Florida, don't get too close to the water because an alligator will come and get you. But other than that, you know, it's good and calming for I think for your entire, your body and your soul.
It is. I really believe that. I think everyone calms down a little bit whenever I'm having trouble writing, I don't sit and look at a blank screen. Whenever I need to think about anything, I get up and walk out into nature.
Now, this is your first, they say this is your first novel?
Yes, this is my first novel.
My goodness, where have you been all these years? I mean, it's about time. Because it's brilliant. I mean, I've been so lucky today. I've had, before you, I had an author whose story was about his great-granddad, and he hadn't been an author, and he came and he decided to write this book, and he did the same thing. He did, in his case, he had to do, you know, research on history, and in your case, it's there in you, this love of nature. All you had to do was sit around and feel it, and you it just sort of comes through the pages how you observe things that most people just overlook.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate you saying that. I appreciate that you got that from the book, because that is what it is about. We all feel nature. We just, some of us more than others, and we learn from it, and we actually physically need it. And I'm glad it came through, because I feel like nature is my best friend. I'm blessed to have a lot of really good friends, but I feel like nature is my best friend. It holds us up when we need everything we need. When you think about it, comes from nature. And maybe except plastic, and I wish we didn't need that. But we need nature, and yet we abuse it. And I think that's part of the lesson of this book. Of course, also this book is a mystery, and it is an intense love story, and it's a courtroom drama. So I wanted to write a page turner. I wanted a book that people wanted to read. They wanted to turn the page to find out what came next, but they also wanted them to feel like they wanted to meander a little bit through the pages to experience nature.
Well,
that was my goal,
and you achieved it, because as you said, it's a mystery, it's a love story. It has so much, and the most beautiful thing is the nature, where I found myself, I'm reading along and I'm enjoying the story, but then every once in a while I'd go back and just read your phrases over about where you're writing about nature, and you're poetical, you're lyrical, and I want to compliment very much the narrator for the Audible version.
Oh, I haven't heard it yet. Thank you.
Oh, my gosh.
I can't wait to hear it. Thank you. I need to hear it.
She is brilliant. She has captured the book.
Oh, good. I have to get... I'm sorry. I'd hate for her to know, but I'm on book tour now. I have not had time to do anything, but thank you for saying that. I can't wait to listen to it.
Her name is Cassandra Campbell, and I believe that she is going to win an award for this Audible version, because it is one of the best Audible versions of a book I have ever heard.
Oh, thank you for saying that. That's great news.
Absolutely. Well, you've done a brilliant job with the book, and I think the nature of it, are you already working on your second novel?
I am.
I knew it. I said the minute I read this book, I said, she's not stopping now, and she better not.
No, I'm on a roll.
That's it, because I'd come after you. I want another book from you. So I hope that in a year or less, you're going to be back here, and we can talk about your next book. And I would like to have. I'm going to do a special book about conservation, so perhaps you'd come on sometime in October and we can talk about the Eye of the Elephant and all of your work in Africa. How about that?
Thank you, Patsy. I'd love to do that. Thank you so much.
Okay.
And thank you for having me on today.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Now, you have a website. Tell everybody about your website.
I have a website, DeliaOwens.com. Very simple. And all the latest news and reviews are on there. And also have an Instagram account. I have never been on social media before, ever. But I was encouraged to get a Facebook and an Instagram. So it's there, too. I'm not as active on those as I should be, but they're there.
Please
visit me if you're so inclined.
Everybody should get this book. It's really, really great, and it is available wherever books are sold, and I think that people will just enjoy it so much on so many levels. And so Where the Crawdads Sing is by Delia Owens, and I want everybody to get it and have fun. Take it to the botanical garden, sit down under a tree, and read and enjoy. Okay?
Thank you, Pat. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks so much, Delia, for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Okay, well, this turned out to be a great, absolutely great day. I'm sorry about that beginning part where we didn't have good reception, but we live and learn, and I will have her back because she is really fascinating. And as I said, it's really poetry in motion when you're reading this book, because she captures the marshland, which is a fascinating thing. So, Delia Owens, William Oldfield, and Victoria Bruce, I want to thank them all for being on the program today. It has been just so much fun. Because remember, one of the things I always tell you is that it is an absolute joy to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. And if you're really lucky, you might even hear them on the big screen one day. And you might be there while they're filming it. And you'll hear lights, camera, action. And that's what some of my people have done, and I'm hoping that Carol J. Perry, hey, Hallmark, wake up. You need Carol J. Perry. We want to see her books made into a miniseries. Okay, and I want to thank Big Ed in the control room, because we had a little mess here today, and he always stays calm when I don't. Okay, bye-bye. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. Bye.